Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Here's Arenas, who's been unbelievable off the bench with some of the length on those three-point shots that he made in the first half. Great pass there to Haywood, and a blocking foul is called.
That's a terrific play by both Arenas and Haywood. The Washington Wizards got squared up late in the clock. Dribble handoff.
Hey, on this edition of the Wizards Talk Podcast, we are on location. It's a private location, so don't be asking. Stay out of our business with one of my favorite dudes I've covered in the NBA. You know him, you love him, Double Zero. The man, the myth, the legend, Brendan Haywood. B. Wood, what's
man,
up, big fella?
Man, what's going on, man? It's man, been way too long,
hey,
man.
Listen, I was just in the neighborhood. I just wanted to stop by and say, Kenji!
You had no problem at the gate, did you?
Yeah, I think I put in the wrong code.
Okay, I was just making sure security didn't come try to escort you off the premises.
Man, it's good to see you, man. I want to start, before we go back and talk about the good old days, when did you know you wanted to get into broadcasting? Because one thing that I have noticed is, first of all, you're a man of many talents. You're at CBS Sports, mm-hmm. NBA TV. You also do Sirius on the radio with that knucklehead Jared Greenberg. But when did broadcasting kind of become in the forefront of your mind?
Well, you know what? When I played in D.C., I did a couple Mystic games in the summertime. So I did that for 2 years, and I really started to like it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, this is something that I could see myself doing. And I did a radio show a couple times in D.C., and I was like, hey, I like the media thing. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I could fit in that space after I retired. I knew I didn't want to coach. Coaching is way too many hours. That's way too hard for me. I don't feel like dealing with anybody.
You don't feel like cussing nobody's parents out if you're in college or high school. And you don't want to deal with agents and GMs.
I don't want to deal with any knuckleheads like myself. I don't want to deal with any of that. And so that was probably 2008, 2009. And as I started getting closer towards retirement, I started just doing more and more things. When I played in Charlotte, I had a full-time radio show in the summertime. I just started doing more and more things to put me in position to be able to do this because I felt like, hey, I could do this for a while.
I could tell early when I was covering you in D.C. that, when someone would ask you a question, you wouldn't be giving you the old canned statement. I feel like you gave yourself some time to process the question first, and then you would deliver what I thought was always thoughtful comments. When did that understanding the realm of the media when you were playing, did you understand that you had to do it? And if you had to do it, you might as well be thought-provoking.
It was just one of those things. Whenever somebody asks me a question, I like to think about the question and give them the best answer possible because I want to put my best foot forward. A lot of people are watching those interviews and, how you come off in that interview is who they think you are. And whether you come off and you don't give good answers or your answers are slow or your answers are bad, they start to get perceptions of you. So I always wanted to have my answers well thought out. And, sometimes maybe a little entertaining because maybe a little funny at times if possible. Old LeBron, he's trying to hurt me, whatever it is. I just try to just do whatever and just try to put my own little spin on it. But I always try to be thoughtful as well.
What has life been like for you away from the game of basketball? You started playing basketball at what age?
I started playing probably around 12. Probably started taking it serious around 14, 15.
About 14, 15. So yeah. We're talking, 20 years of playing basketball? How has life away from the game kind of been like for you now?
It's been great. I mean, I've been able to continuously be involved in basketball. That's the big thing for me. Even when I retired, I'm doing stuff for NBA TV. I'm working for CBS. I'm covering the NCAA tournament for Turner Sports. So I'm still involved in basketball. I always tell people, man, I have the greatest job ever. After I retire, I'm getting paid to watch games I was going to watch anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because I'm just a basketball, I'm a hoops junkie. So it's a great thing for me, man. So life outside of basketball, not outside of basketball, but away from the game, away from the NBA, it's been great. It's been a smooth transition, something that I've loved doing. And then, you know, just enjoying being old, retired, ex-sport NBA athlete, doing stuff for the first time, man. I was talking to my wife. I was like, man, when I retired my first year, I was like, man, I made my first doctor's appointment today. You know, like when you're an NBA player, you never make any of your own appointments. I'm like, it's the first time I have to do stuff. I made my own dentist appointment today. So
it's things like that I don't think people kind of realize about when you're going through the grind of an NBA season, an NBA career, the things that you do.
We take for granted. Athletes, we are super spoiled, and it's great. Don't be ashamed of it, athletes. Hey, enjoy your time to be spoiled. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you just get used to, like, you know, you talk to the trainer, hey, man, you know, I'm feeling a little sick. Can you send me a doctor's appointment? Then you get a text. Yeah, be there at this time. Okay.
Now
I got to do it myself.
When was the last time you went grocery shopping?
I used to go grocery shopping on my own. Yeah, I would go at that weird time so people wouldn't bother me. Like, I might go, like, super early in the morning, like 6 a.m., or I might go, like, late. You might see me at the grocery store shopping at, like, midnight at a store. But yeah, I would do my own grocery shopping.
All right. We got to get to the playing days.
Mm-hmm.
My producer, your old friend Terrence Stroder, I talked to him today, and I said, I got to ask B. Woods something that I probably don't know, because I feel like I know a lot about it. And he brought up, ask Brendan if he still hates LeBron James.
You know what? I never hated LeBron James.
Oh, he's trying to hurt me. I mean, come on, man. This is the playoffs, man. He wears 23. He wants to be Michael Jordan. I can respect that. He's a great player. You saw what Mike went through. Mike got fouled way worse than this. You know what I'm saying? No one's trying to hurt him. Everybody's trying to play basketball, trying to play tough. Play basketball, leave it alone.
Trying to hurt me.
Yeah,
considering he was your teammate in Cleveland for, like, what, 5 seconds?
Yeah, but I don't even really count that. It wasn't with my teammate. I just got to sit down and watch LeBron James that year. I didn't really get to check in much. I was like, ooh, that boy good. He's real talented. He's got a future. He keep this up.
So
I never hated LeBron James. You want to know what happened, why they thought we – Deshaun Stevenson.
Well, first of all, you threw him into the fifth row, so yes.
Okay, you want to know the story behind that, though?
Yes.
After game one in the playoffs, LeBron – we're watching the film, and LeBron's doing all the flexing, all the and-ones, and doing all the gyrations and everything. And Eddie Jordan stops the film, and he says, listen, Brendan, if LeBron gets any type of – half-court dunks and ones or anything, I don't care where you are on the court, it's on you. You coming out. He's like, I'm not saying like – he's like, but if he gets any big-time dunks, you need to be there to either foul him or block the shot. I'm like, all right.
It just – you felt like that was a green light.
I'm like, cool. And it just so happens on a play, I'm at the top of the key, and Caron Butler gets backdoored in the corner. And I look, and I'm a step late, and I'm running over there, and I see LeBron cocking his ball back, and I'm thinking to myself, I can't let him dunk it, but there's no way I'm going to block this either,
right.
And I'm not going to be on this poster. So I decided to give him a love tap. And then from there on, it was like, oh, there's a robbery. It was never a robbery. I just wasn't trying to get taken out the game.
You appreciate it. You did exactly what your coach told you to do. So for the record.
I always did what Eddie Jordan told me to do. What? What, man? What's wrong with you, man?
No.
You're not going to come to my house and disrespect me, are you?
No, but, Brendan, this is, like, not just an audio podcast. This is a video podcast.
Okay.
So people can see your face when you said what you just said just now.
I don't know.
You're telling me you and Coach Jordan were always on the same page?
I just seen Coach Jordan at the airport the other day. I promise you I did.
Did you exchange pleasantries?
I didn't speak. But you saw
him, and then you just kept it moving.
No, I saw him from a distance, though. I saw him from a distance.
All right. I want to ask you about the big three era.
Mm-hmm.
Gilbert, Caron, Antoine. Before I get to that, breaking news.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you heard this. Agent Zero is playing in the big three.
Man.
I have to get your reaction to that.
Man. First thing, I just want Gilbert to be safe because, you know, them knees got a little crickly as he got older. So, those knees was made of tissue paper towards the end. So, I don't Gil, you my guy. Be safe out there. If those knees start acting up, go ahead, ice them up and sit them on down. We're not as young as we used to be.
They got a lot of old jokers out there, man.
Yeah,
you seen Coutinho Mobley these days?
Yeah, but Coutinho Mobley, he look old, but he moving like he's young.
Gotcha.
Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf.
Yes.
Yeah, those guys, they older, but they still moving well. You know, Gil had a lot of surgeries on those knees. Gil, be safe, man. Be safe. If those knees start acting up,
he said he wanted to bring the band back together, all the big guys, and just so he could shoot the ball more.
Yeah, man. Hey, listen, there is no way in the world I'm going to come out there and set all them screens and not get the ball again from Gilbert. I love Gil. There's no way I'm coming out there doing. Hey, he better call Kwame Brown for that, because I ain't coming back.
Now, I would say this: when you were playing towards the end of your time in DC, they would run some plays for you early in the game to get you going, big fella. True or false?
Yeah, true. True.
Okay. They just kind of forgot about you as the game went on.
Listen,
huh?
Man, they was just throwing me a bone. You know, they realized if we get the big fella a couple touches here and there, he don't need many. But if we get him a couple of touches so he can throw up his jump hook, then he'll rebound a little bit better for us. He'll block a couple more shots.
Run the floor, set some good screens.
Yeah, so that's all it was just to keep me happy. I appreciate those little touches.
You played with several teams, but I want you to talk about specifically that era. Clearly, it didn't end the way people wanted it to end, but when it was good, how good was it?
When it was good, it was really good. That is actually some of my most fond basketball memories. Now, 2011 with the Mavericks, yes, we won a championship. That is the tops for me. But some of those plane rides, the bus trips, the camaraderie with some of those guys on those Wizard teams is just phenomenal. We had some good times. I don't think we maximized our potential because we were young and undisciplined. Looking back now, we could have been a much better team had we had a little bit more discipline, a little bit more structure. But some of the relationships I made, guys like Roger Mason Jr., Jared Jeffries, Caron Butler, these are going to be my guys forever. And it's big, and it goes beyond basketball. So yeah. I had a great time. That team was very good. We had some epic battles with Cleveland. Cleveland won all of them, but it was still fun nonetheless. I forgot Deshaun Stevenson in there, my guy for life as well. So I had some very, very good times playing on those basketball teams. And I think we were excited because at that point, Wizards hadn't made the playoffs in a very, very long time. And I always tell people that moment when we were down 0-2 to the Chicago Bulls in that series, and this was the first time a playoff basketball had been in D.C. and I don't know, in ages, since like the Chris Webber, Juwan Howard realm. And when we came in there and we were about to take the court, and they started playing that old Jay-Z takeover, you know how the beat comes in, dun, dun, dun. And you know, D.C. is a late arriving crowd because, you know, it's a black crowd. So it's a late arriving
crowd. I'm done.
Hey, listen. D.C. is a late arriving crowd, but everybody was there early, and they were waving those white towels, and they were like, coming out, you Washington Wizards. And they had that Jay-Z beat playing in the background, and everybody, it was the loudest. That was the loudest, most energy I've ever felt coming out of the tunnel. I'll never forget that moment. Man, I was about to try like a windmill or a 360 dunk, and you know I didn't have hops like that. I might have hurt myself, but the crowd had me hyped up to try it.
D.C. is a basketball town.
Yeah.
As much as people talk about the Redskins is the NFL, yes. But I feel like when those years, during those three straight years where you played the Cavaliers, I thought D.C. had the Verizon Center at the time was what it was called, had that place really turned up. When Gilbert hit that shot in Chicago.
On the inbounds pass, they're on their feet here in Chicago. Arenas, played by Heinrich, both teams over the limit. Here's Arenas, this for the win. Yes! The Wizards!
To bring the series back to D.C. for you guys to ultimately close it out. What do you remember about what was drawn up in the huddle and him ultimately hitting that shot?
Oh, man. Talking about behind-the-scenes stories. You know what I remember the most about that? The shot wasn't for Gilbert. The play was not drawn up for Gilbert Arenas. If you go back and look at it, the play was for Larry Hughes. Gil was supposed to catch the ball, get it in, take a couple dribbles. I was supposed to set a weak side screen for Larry. Larry was supposed to curl the screen, get it, and get the shot. And the funniest thing is talking to Gil, probably like on maybe a day later, I was like, man. I said, dog, did you see that Larry was wide open? Like, Larry's wide open on the play. The play actually worked. It was drawn up perfectly. The play worked. Larry was wide open. He said, did you see Larry? He said, nah, man. I said, did you know the play? He said, nah, I didn't know the play. I said, what do you mean you didn't know the play? He said, I was listening. As soon as Eddie said, I get the ball, All I need to know is where I got the ball, and I wasn't focused on nothing else except I was going to shoot. He said, my mentals went somewhere else. He said, once they drew the play up, and they said, okay, Gillen, you catch the ball here? He said, I didn't hear anything else. The play was actually not for him. If you think ask Gil next time you see him, ask Larry. The play was not for Gilbert. The play was supposed to be a weak down pin. It was supposed to be a weak side pin down for Larry Hughes.
And I did not know that. I did not know. Larry's supposed to get.
Larry was supposed to get the ball.
Now, is that when Agent Zero was born? When do you think, like, the start of Agent Zero actually happened?
I think Agent Zero was as soon as Gilbert came into D.C. He was different. He did things his way. Gilbert was out there playing in Air Max low-cut running shoes. He was different mentally. And his mindset mentally allowed him to be so great. He had no fear. He didn't fear Kobe Bryant. That's why he was able to drop 60. You know what I'm saying? Like, he didn't fear anybody. You know, playing the Spurs, Tony Parker gave Tony Parker 40 in three quarters. Like, he didn't fear anybody. So once he got to D.C. and he realized it was his team, and then there was a unique bond between him and Larry because they had their bond from Golden State.
Right.
Big brother, little brother. But Larry was big brother. And he empowered Gil so much. And Gil felt so empowered that he just kept running with that. And a star was born. He was very eccentric. I think that he was the first guy really doing, like, the blog thing and all this stuff that athletes do now. Gilbert was the first one doing it. He was paying for his own billboards. He was just doing things differently, and that created Agent Zero, aka the Hibachi, all that, and took DC by storm. I think he's one of the most slept on guards in NBA history because his run was cut down by injury. You know, he had a 3-year run where you really look like, wow, he was doing something special. Also think he wasn't appreciated because he was before his time.
Yeah.
Back then they wanted all the guards to play like Jason Kidd. And now it's all about scoring guards. If Gil was around in this era where you can't be physical, you can't touch people, and scoring guards are all the rage. He could no question average, 30 points per game. He was getting you like 27, 28 back when the league was a little bit more physical.
Yeah.
And that wasn't even in style. So, when I look at Dame Lillard and when I look at all these guards that score the ball, I think Gilbert would fit in well with any of those guys in today's game.
As good as it was, it came to a crashing end.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I do know this for a fact that when Gilbert got traded to Orlando, we went down to Orlando and we interviewed him. And I got the sense then that he was still upset about how he was dealt, the things that happened. But I haven't asked him this in probably, 10 years. Do you think he regrets how it ended in Washington?
I think Gilbert regrets. I think he has to. And just not because of anything in particular, but just as athletes, you want to be in control of your own destiny. And I think that whether it was the injury situation, that's another crazy story. He almost didn't play that night. Like, I know he wishes he probably didn't play the night Jerrell Wallace fell into his knee. So whether it was the injury situation, whether it's the situation, with Javaris Crittenden and how that all ended, everybody makes mistakes. Gil is harmless. That story has been twisted and turned into so many different things, and people just don't understand that Gil is different. He's eccentric, and that situation was initially just supposed to be a joke, and it spiraled out of control, and it turned into something totally different and led to some different things. And I'm sure, thinking back now, definitely would have handled things differently.
Because a lot of guys paid the price.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately the franchise turn the corner.
Well, it worked out well for a couple guys. Me, Karan, Deshaun Stevenson. We went on to greener pastures in Dallas and won a championship.
You ain't got a trip.
Thanks, Gil.
Well, I'm sure you guys would have wanted to do it in D.C. And it's interesting you just brought up Karan. So Larry gets moved on. Karan comes in, and he's now the new part of the Big Three. And I remember one training camp. We were in Richmond. And it was after Gilbert came back from the knee injuries, and Karan had essentially became a 2-time All-Star while Gil was gone. And it didn't take me long. Now, it's me. Now, I can't imagine you guys how long it took, that there was a seat change a little bit where Karan thought he was that dude now. Did you guys as teammates get that sense of the rub a little bit between the two of them?
I think there was definitely a little bit of tension because at that point, egos are involved. And people start, who's the alpha? Whose team is it? And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter whose team it is. But when you're in it, you can't see that. So I definitely think both guys had their different views of how the situation should go. You know, Gil was out. Karan thought, hey, I've been balling. It's my team. Gil was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Before I left, it was my team. And so there was probably definitely some things, a little bit of tension. It was never a Shaq and Kobe type situation, but there was probably a little bit of uneasiness. But the biggest thing that I always think about in D.C. that was underappreciated was that for our team, no one realized that Larry Hughes was the leader. And when we replaced Larry with Karan, Karan went on to do great things. But what I talked to you earlier was that Larry Hughes spoke a language to Gil because it's big brother, little brother. Even though Gil was Agent Zero, he still looked at Larry as big brother. Larry was the leader of that team. Larry was the guy that kept Gil in line. And, you know, Larry was a man of few words. And when Gil would go off the handle, I'd be like, Larry, go say something to him. And he would only say a couple of things. And next thing you know, Gil would be back just like that. And that was probably the thing.
Larry was undervalued then.
He was undervalued because you can't put a price on leadership. And sometimes management doesn't know those type of things, or sometimes they don't view them in the realm that they should be. But Karan had great years there. I love Karan as a teammate. But for our team, Larry was the leader of that team. And when they treated the leader of that team, that's when you had the rift a little bit between Gil and Karan. But Larry was, like, the original big three was Larry, Gil, and Antoine. And Larry meant a lot to us because he inspired confidence in guys like Jared Jeffries, myself. He would always tell me, I go set the screen, like, nah, man, go down there and post up. And that little things like that mean a lot because, oh, okay, he wasn't going to give it to me 10 times in a row, but right. You give it to me one or two times, he understood what that meant. He understood what to say to Gil, how to inspire Jared, the little things to say. And so I think that's the one thing I look at. Gil and Karan, they didn't really they once in a while rub each other the wrong way, but the biggest thing I saw in my time there was that Larry was very underappreciated, and I don't think people, or especially people up top in management, realized just how much he meant to Gilbert Arenas and the leadership of this team.
You were a part of two eras in D.C., and I want you to talk about maybe the compare and contrast the two. You were there when Michael Jordan was ending his, I don't even know what superlative to describe his career. And then you were a part of that big three era with Larry, you know, and then the next, you know, with Karan. Playing with Michael Jordan at that time, as somebody that is a Tar Heel, what was that like just being around him as he was closing out his playing career?
I mean, it was great just because you really got to see the myth behind all the greatness. You got to go, he wasn't good by accident. You got to see a guy that's 40 years old still getting to the gym at 8 o'clock, working on his game, working on his body, figuring out how to do things the right way, working on his individual post moves, going, playing, doing things one-on-one, showing the footwork and everything. All his moves are calculated. I would see him sometimes working out with Bobby Simmons and showing him stuff like, yeah, see, I'm jabbing this way to see what he's going to do. And when he does that, I'm going to counter back with this spin up and under, hit a shoulder fake, everything. So all seeing Mike go through his footwork, his day-to-day regimen, and seeing what it was to really be the GOAT, that's what I took away from that, because I learned a lot just watching how he went about his business.
Was he as hard on Kwame as it's been reported over the years?
Yeah, that was a weird situation because Kwame came in 19 years old like everybody else. And, you know, he came in and it's Mike, but Mike is about winning. Mm-hmm. And Kwame almost we all looked up to Mike. And I think that kind of got in the way for Kwame being 19, not going to college, not having that background. It was like he was looking for Mike's approval, and Mike's not giving you the approval unless you can really hoop, unless you can really play. He's not giving you the stamp. You have to earn it. And I think sometimes that kind of wore on Kwame, and it just led to him being down a little bit. And he just had to, like, I don't think he understood the business aspect of it. And Mike's not here to be your friend, bro. Mike's trying to win. And if you can't help him win, he don't like you. That's what it comes down to.
So you have really intimate knowledge of MJ. I want to go back to, like, playing at Carolina. I mean, clearly you just, you know, if you ever walk into the Dean Dome, you know what it's like.
That's up there. That jersey hanging up there.
And you just look up there. It's blue heaven, as 2-3. I call it. I mean, you're a kid from Greensboro, North Carolina. what were your thoughts as you were getting yourself prepared to go to Carolina and play, you know, for that unbelievable program? As a guy that was from Greensboro, you went to Dudley, right?
Yeah, Greensboro Dudley.
Man, you just went down the street to go to school.
Yeah. For me, I didn't understand the situation at that point. I didn't understand what I was walking into, mm-hmm. because I was 17. And I was just like, man, I'm going off to college. Mm-hmm. And when I walked out into the Dean Dome for my first game looking around, then I really, when you hear the band playing, you see the students, I really understood what it was. But for me, the preparation was, I'm just trying to be the best I can, try to possibly get in the game my freshman year, create a little niche for myself, and see what happens from there. I didn't worry about everybody that came before me or anything like that, just because I believe in taking it day by day and building a solid foundation. And so I just tried to work hard, do the best I could. And then by about my sophomore year, I was like, yo, I think I can make some money doing this basketball thing.
It was until your sophomore year of college?
Well, I was
not even in high school. You didn't think like you had a chance?
I had a different high school background than most guys end up at Carolina. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the man on my team from like ninth grade all the way down. There was a guy by the name of Vincent Witt. He was the best player. Carolina discovered me going to see him. Vincent Witt was a top 25 recruit that was coming out at the time. And when Carolina would come see him, you know, they were trying to get him. He ended up going to Clemson. They were like, hey, man, who's the big kid?
Who's the big
kid in the corner? And then eventually, you know, I got my opportunity and I was able to play. And I was on that team. Once again, Witt was still the star, but I continued to grow. And so at that point, like, I wasn't the man. I wasn't even the second best player on my team my junior year. It was Vincent Witt and a guy by the name of Braxton Williams. And so I didn't know if I was going to go to the NBA. I was the guy that got cut from the JV team my ninth grade year.
Wow.
You know, the head coach for the basketball, David Price, the head coach for the Dudley Panthers, mm-hmm. he actually went back my ninth grade year and got me off the bus and said, hey, man, you're on the team. I was like, nah, the coach cut me. He said, I'm telling the coach to keep you.
Because how tall were you your ninth grade year?
I was about 6'5".
6'5".
And so he's still in my life, and he's just like, listen, you don't cut size like that. You never know what it can turn into. Yeah. And that's what happened. I ended up turning into a top D1 recruit and an NBA player. But at that point, when I was, you know, that age, I didn't think I was going to the pros. In ninth grade, I didn't even make the team. I couldn't even play JV. I didn't even go up for varsity. They cut me from JV. So it was like, so then when I got to Carolina, I was just like trying to see if I belonged. And when I really realized I could hold my own was in the summertime when the guys – when the Rasheeds and the George Lynches and the Eric Montrosses came back. And I was like – I was going to my sophomore year. I was like, I can hold my own with these guys. And then I went on to have a pretty good sophomore year. And I was like, I'm going to be in the pros.
Yeah, right.
But that's how my process went along. I didn't come through like an O.J. Mayo who was like the top player from 14 all the way through or like a guy like LeBron or anybody like that. I was totally off the radar, off the map, until I just jumped on the map my junior year of high school.
Quick trivia question for people that might not know this. This guy right here was the first Tar Heel in school history to ever record a triple-double. There's only been two of them. He had the first one. It was against Miami. I want you to tell the story about when you found out that you indeed had the first triple-double in school history and then what your reaction to it was.
I just thought there had to be somebody else that had a triple-double before me. You know, Michael Jordan, Sam Perkins, right. Rasheed. And so when they were first like, you're the first triple-double in Carolina basketball history, I was like, me?
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 This guy?
Me? This guy right here?
I got cut in ninth grade.
The awkward kid from Greensboro. But, yeah, and so it was humbling for me because I know so many great basketball players have come before me, and I was the first one to do it. And whenever you're the first to do something, you're always going to be in the record books.
What was the last stat? Was it the block? What was the last thing to get you the triple-double? Do you remember?
I think it was the block.
It was the block.
Because I had a lot of blocks that night against Miami. You know, they kept bringing it inside. You know, it's like the Mutombo finger. No.
Not tonight.
You know, so I just had one of those good nights.
That's awesome, man. I remember, obviously, you know, I've been a Tar Heel fan my whole life, and I remember that night. And I was just like, and he kept saying it. I'm like, Nick, there's no way B was the first one.
Yep, the first.
And there's only been two since. So you have a unique experience now watching a lot of college basketball. The question I always ask the OGs that played at Carolina is, do you still hate that school in Durham?
You know what? I have to be a professional because I cover college basketball. I don't hate Duke. I just never root for them. I don't hate them.
Right.
I don't wish any ill will upon those guys. Zion, RJ Barrett, they have a tremendous amount of talent. I just never root for them. I never pull for them. I was so disappointed in Louisville the other day.
Come on, Louisville. You was better than that.
Louisville, you're better than that. We were all counting on you.
How good is that team and particularly Zion?
This Duke team is truly special and truly scary to a certain degree because everybody saw the game they had against Louisville where they just basically came back from 23 down with 9 minutes to play. No team they've had the last 4 to 5 years, even the team they won a championship with Jahlil Okafor, none of those teams could have made that comeback because none of those teams defended. Like this team right now is two top-tier lottery picks, another first-rounder in Trey Jones, but they all defend and play at a high level. Duke has finally got back to old-school defense like when Shane Battier and those guys were there. So they're truly a team to be feared right now, and I think they have a good chance of winning it because they're the most talented team in college basketball, but they're also one of the hardest working. You got to salute Coach K.
As a big man that played in the league.
Man, it didn't sound right, but yeah, got to salute Coach K.
It sounded weird. It's yeah. Like, but as a guy that played in the league, at your position, and you see a guy like Zion, is he 6'6"? I'm wondering, like, how tall he is. We'll find out at the combine officially. Brendan, how does his game translate to the next level?
He's unique. We really haven't seen anything like him. And everybody keeps saying what he is or what he isn't. Right? He's an athlete. He's a hooper. His ceiling is, what did Michael Jordan say? The ceiling is through the roof. Or the ceiling is the roof.
The ceiling is the roof.
I'm standing on the roof. I don't even know what that means, Mike. I love you, but I have no idea what that means.
The ceiling is the roof. Let's make it happen. Let's keep moving forward.
But Zion can go so high because he's a unique talent. We're talking about somebody that's 285, incredibly bouncy, quick first step. He can do a lot of different things. But he's still raw to a certain degree. Like when you watch him, what's his go-to move?
Dunking.
Doesn't have one.
Dunking on people hard.
Yeah, but so you see, okay, doesn't have a go-to move. Mid-range jumpers lacking. Three-point jumpers a little spotty. Average at the free throw line. So when I look at Zion, I look at him as just unmolded clay because he's averaging over 20, and his offensive package isn't even there yet. So if he continues to grow and continues to develop, he can take it to another level, and that – just the level he goes to depends on how much work he puts in and how much he improves. If he develops the go-to move, if he becomes a better spot-up shooter, then he's something unique. I think he's rock solid, but I think he still probably needs to lose maybe 20 pounds because at 285, all that jumping, I want him to be able to play for a long time. That pounding on your body 10, 12, 11 years, it'll break you down. And so you don't want to come into the league at 19 and by the age of 29, you're having knee problems because you've been a little heavy for the last decade. So drop a couple of LBs, develop a go-to move. No telling what can happen for him.
Tell me about RJ Barrett.
Man, heavy left-handed, incredibly tough. Mentally, he's one of those guys that just believes in himself. You know, he's not scared of any shot. And there's a reason why they go to him down the stretch, not Zion, because he believes I'm the guy. And in today's game of basketball, with everything spread out, pick and roll is all about guys his size being able to do multiple things. I think he's going to be an incredible star as well because he can drive to the basket, get anywhere he wants to. He competes defensively, and then he has the mental toughness. His jumper is a little spotty at times as well, but he's not afraid to take it. That's the first step, and he's going to continue to get better with it. Like these guys, they're babies. They're 18, 19 years old. They're not going to be finished products, but both of these guys I think are going to be all-stars, no doubt. The work they put in will tell you, will they be all-stars or superstars?
I can't believe we've had this much talk about that school.
But they're good, man. You got to give them their due.
The other guy on that team who I saw in high school drop 40, and it was the easiest 40 I've seen in a while, is Cam Reddish. And I just feel like that guy has more offensive skill. He has more basketball skill than I think the other two. But he's like the third option. And he's a 6'8" two guard, Brendan. What am I missing with Cam Reddish? Why is he not being talked about like the other two?
He's not being talked about like the other two because he's not producing. I mean, I saw him in high school as well, but he's a shooter that's not shooting the ball well. He's averaged about 12 points per game, but he's shooting 37, 38% from the field. Those are very low numbers for a guy that's supposed to be able to shoot at 6'8". I think the biggest thing that's hurting Cam Reddish is that he's the third option. he's used to being the guy. And sometimes when you're used to being the man and getting a certain amount of touches and a certain amount of looks, and they tell you you're not getting that anymore, some guys have a problem adapting to that. I'm sure he's going to go on to become a great pro. When you look at his stroke, it looks pure. It just hasn't gone in at the rate that we thought it would. That's why he's not being mentioned with those other two guys, because he hasn't played on the level of those other two guys as of yet.
So we've talked a lot about that team, but who else in the country have you seen on TV, maybe in person, you're like, they might actually have a chance against that school from Durham?
Oh, man, there's a lot of schools this year. Obviously, Gonzaga beat them early this year, and if you watched how they beat them, they played physical. Duke does a lot of switching, and if you have competent post players, when you switch, if they just seal at the front of the rim and get physical, you can get a lot of layups, and that's exactly what Gonzaga did. So I look at teams that can match that, and also you have to have some good guard play because Trey Jones is going to pressure you, so you got to have a guard that can beat that. So I look at teams like Tennessee, Admiral Schofield, Grant Williams inside. They're physical. They can definitely give Duke a hard time. Rick Barnes, great coach as well.
Pride of Asheville, North Carolina.
I look at a team like Kentucky. Every year, Coach Cal sprinkles that magic, and you see a team that looks like this at the beginning of the year, and by the end of the year, you're like, oh, that team's real good.
Right.
And he's got them competing. P.J. Washington has really stepped it up. I think he scored like 20 or better in like five of his last six. So I like that team. I like that team as well. They're very strong inside. Don't forget about my Tar Heels. Top five offensive team in the nation. I think they're actually number three. Cam Johnson, ACC's best three-point shooter this year. Kobe White. Listen, this guy is 6'5", but he moves like Ty Lawson.
It's crazy because I saw him last summer, two summers ago, I think, when he was playing for CP3. And everybody kept talking about him. And I'm like, dog, he's 6'5".
Yes.
Like, I didn't realize how tall he was until you see him in person because, the hair and all that other stuff. He's a big guard. And is he the fastest guard Roy's had since Ty?
He's the fastest guard since Ty. No question. No question. Not even close. Like, when you watch him move, and the thing is, he's advanced because a lot of the other really quick guards, whether we're talking about Raymond Felton or Ty Lawson, they didn't have the jumper that he has right now.
Right.
And, those guys went on to play several seasons there. I don't think he's going to have to play that. He might be out after this season. Sorry, Roy, but he's playing that well. So I think Carolina has a chance to do some damage as well because offensively, they can get it going. They can. Roy pushes tempo. They can hit shots. And so I think that's special.
It's all about rebounding.
It definitely is about rebounding. We got to get that done. But we'll see how that turns out. And definitely a dark horse team, not talked about as much. And this wouldn't be about the team. It'd be about the player. Marquette. Marcus Howard is probably one of the most phenomenal undersized guards you're going to see in college basketball who scores the ball. He scored 45 on a number of occasions. He's dropped 50. He is just an incredible scorer. Only about 5'11", but he's capable in the tournament. Guys get hot and go on these runs. Yeah. He's one of those guys that can go on a run and carry a team to the Final Four.
When you say a small guard that can get on a run, I always think about Randolph Childress.
Mm.
And I just...
Shout out to Jeff McGinnis' ankles.
I always think about just those 3 days and just go... I'll end on this one. Your favorite moment and all the stops you've had from college to the pros, each team.
Favorite moment. So we're going college first. Mm-hmm. Favorite moment college would be hitting the game-winning free throws at Duke in Cameron Indoor. That was special.
Carolina with a chance to win it.
You don't want to foul.
Haywood contact and the foul on Batty. Are you kidding?
Did I call a foul out of the perimeter?
Are these huge for Brendan Haywood? What a great stroke by the 7-footer.
I mean, there was no doubt the way he stroked that one.
Because my freshman year, I missed the game-winning free throws at Duke. So going back there doing it my senior year was special. So favorite moment in college, that would have to be it. Favorite moment, are you talking about just NBA or just team by team?
Team by team.
Team by team, favorite moment with the Wizards would be the one I described earlier, coming out that tunnel for that energy. All that energy we had. And then... game winner, I had a game winner against the Knicks. That felt good. I didn't have a lot of game winners in my career, so having a game winner against the Knicks, that was special for me. Dallas, you already know what it is. Favorite moment.
Win that chip.
winning the trophy, because I never thought I was going to be an NBA champion. And then that team, no one thought we were going to win a title. We were like, the fifth seed. Mm-hmm. We were predicted to lose every single series. Like, Portland's going to knock them off. We beat them. then the next series comes, and it's like, well, yeah, they're going to let, oh, the Lakers. We playing, oh, Lakers going to get them. We sweep them in Kobe's run. Then we go against those young guns out there back when it was Harden, Russ, and KD. How do y'all mess that up, OKC? I'm still trying to figure it out. Man, somebody needs to answer those type of questions. Somebody should be fired. Hey, you let that much talent walk out the door, somebody should be fired, man.
Talk to him, B. Will.
Hey, listen here. I couldn't be owning you. You'd be out there looking for work. But we took on that team as well, then beat that team, then the LeBron James-led Heat team. The Heatles, no one thought we could. So that Dallas Maverick team was truly special. That's one of my most precious moments ever, because we did something no one thought was possible. Then I had stops in Charlotte. I'm trying to think. Best moment in Charlotte.
You're coming home, essentially.
Yeah, but we only won like 19 games.
So was it
21 games?
So was it the introductory press conference?
It might have been. That might have been. That might have been the highlight.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome home, Brendan Haywood. Hey, it's good to be here,
Jackson.
Next moment.
Yeah. And then even like my last year in Cleveland, I think I had one last game of the season. I hit the game winning shot. Last game of the season, and that was big time. You know, they let the guys, the scrubs, play. They don't get in the last game, and so I got in the fourth quarter, and I was able to hit the game winning shot. Actually, a mid range jumper, which was a little bit different for me.
I always in my interviews like this, and you know, you're a good friend of mine, and I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, how would Brendan Haywood like to be remembered as a person and as a player?
As a player, just somebody that enjoyed the game, very good rebounder, shot blocker, finisher around the rim. As a person, I just like to be known as somebody that cared about my teammates, was good in the community, just a good overall person to be around. You know, at the end of the day, when people walk away and they ask you about different people, you want them to say your name, be like, man, he's just a good dude.
Yeah.
And that's just how I like to be remembered, that he's a good guy.
Well, you got raised right.
Say what?
You got raised right. You was from good stock.
Okay.
By the way, we're not going to tell you where we are, but, man, it's pretty nice out here.
Hey, man.
So what happens when you have over – how many years in the league?
I played 14, and I ain't spend a lot of money.
You know, I did avoid that. I did avoid that, but I will say this. One of the cheapest people you will ever meet in the league.
Nah, I had a teammate that was cheaper.
See, there's some things that I was going to leave.
I had a teammate that was cheaper than me,
and I know who he was, but I wanted to leave that off.
He was wearing like corduroy suits in like 2008 with Wallabies. I'm like, man, where you get that from, man? Like the back of Michael J. Fox's DeLorean.
Can you confirm or deny you went at least 10 years not spending your per diem?
No, that's a false.
That's false.
That's a farce. That's not true.
Because the streets were talking.
No, now my rookie year, I didn't spend that per diem. I took that per diem home. I was living like I was broke. I didn't know how long this NBA thing was gonna last. I got those checks on the. I got those per diem envelopes. I was like, oh, all this for me?
This for me?
This is not my contract. This is extra. Man, I had all them envelopes at the end of the year. Had me a good time in the summer.
But it's the best thing.
Yeah.
Because look where you are now. By being conscious of the money that you were making at that time gives you the opportunities now to do what you love instead of doing what you got to do to pay the bills.
Yeah.
My man.
Plus, it's lucky to have Lake Varnell in the back.
Hey, man, it's Brendan Haywood, man. We chopping it up on the Wizards Talk podcast. We out of here.
Haywood makes them both, and now Duke is going to use a timeout with 1.2 seconds to go.